Welcome to the NorCal Real Estate Show, where we're talking all things real estate in Yolo, Sacramento, and Solano counties. My name is Jeremy Higgins. I am the founder and team lead of the Higgins team at eXp Realty, and I am joined by...
Andrew Loyevsky.
And we've also got Mr. Nate Darling, our producer, with us. How you doing, Nate?
Doing great, guys. How are you today?
Doing fantastic. Got my butt kicked in golf by Andrew yesterday. That sucked. The guy had a record-breaking round for himself.
Shot an 88.
How did you do that, dude?
It was a great day.
It's not fair, though. You hit a drive. We measured it at 363 yards. You had the wind at your back, but bro.
Hey, swing hard and good things happen, right?
That's not fair. How in the world am I supposed to beat a 363-yard drive?
You know, when you're playing for money, sometimes you just got to take it up another level.
It was money and trash talking from my wife because she was going to, yeah, anyway. Well, welcome to the show today. We're going to be talking about this interesting market that we're in, the buyer fatigue that we're seeing. We've seen a lot of buyers bailing from the market. They feel like the competition's a bit too high. The risk is increasing for them. So we want to talk about, should they be doing that? Should they not? Is it a good idea? Is it not? We also, if we have enough time, we want to talk about non-contingent offers. Are they good? Are they bad? What do they mean? But before we do that, we're going to start with a quick tip of the day. Andrew, you have a quick tip?
Home staging.
Homes are flying off the market today in this market. Is it even worth it?
Statistically, people are saying, other agents are reporting that it's adding anywhere from 5 to 10 to even sometimes 15% value to the home after it's been staged. So that alone, definitely worth it.
Yeah, I Googled that right before the show, and Google tells everything's accurate on Google, but they said agent, there's a little snippet said agents representing sellers put a high dollar value on home staging. About 22% reported a bump in sales price of up to 5%. I definitely agree with that. At least 5%.
At least 5%.
17% reported an increase of up to 10%. I could see that happening. And then there's a crazy 2% out there that said that the payback could be up to 20%, but I think they're smoking.
That's a little bit of an outlier. You know, home staging, definitely worth it. With buyers, it's a lot of psychology. You know, everyone, when you go and look at new construction, right, they always have the model homes available for you to look at, and they're always decked out, designed to the hilt, upgraded everything. Everyone loves those homes. And when we do home staging, we try to make the home look like a perfect model home. And buyers are just more drawn to that. It looks more turnkey. It looks clean and fresh. And people love that.
Yeah. I mean, we're in the fortunate position where we get to see the houses before they get staged. And then there's this period of time where our staging team goes in and does the staging, but we're not really there for that process. And then we come back right out, you know, a couple days later, and all of a sudden this house looks crazy. And one of the things that I noticed was when we go into these vacant homes that have no furniture in or anything like that, you start, it's very easy to see all of the little imperfections. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's a dirt spot on that floor. There's cracked tiles in the kitchen. You know, there's scuff marks on the wall or whatnot. Yep. And granted, a lot, you know, some sellers are taking care of all of that, but I would agree in this market, or I think you would agree in this market, that investing too much in the too much money in a house may not get you the return you wanted. But when we put staging in there, and it's well layered with furniture and artwork and plants and flower vases and all that kind of stuff, when you walk in, your eye is drawn to the furniture and the staging, and suddenly that stain on the carpet just doesn't pop out. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you walk into a vacant home, an empty home, and it just has like a cold, kind of stark feeling to it, right? It doesn't feel homey. And statistically, buyers just aren't willing to go over the top on prices compared to a home that's staged and, you know, has a nice warm feel to it.
As someone who cruises through real estate listings here and there, because I'll see a sign somewhere and I'm like, oh, I wonder what that house is like. Whenever I go in, there's two things that are kind of a turnoff. One is when the photos are with all of the junk that is the person who lives there now. And the other one is absolutely, completely, and totally empty. Because you do, you see all of the imperfections. You're like, well, what am I going to do with that space? What's that for? I don't really, it feels like a lot more work to go, what am I going to do there? It feels like intuitively it would be, oh no, I want people to be able to see what they can do to make it their own. But for the most part, people don't necessarily want that. People want to see something and go, oh, I see what they did there. I can change that and make it my own, as opposed to being dealt with a blank canvas. It's sort of like if you ever deal with a graphic designer, and the worst thing you can tell a graphic designer is do whatever you want. I'm completely open to anything. And they're like, I don't even know where to start with that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same sort of, that same sort of idea of, I kind of want to know what you're thinking here, and I may not agree with it, but I know I can make that better. And then it's suddenly a challenge to make that room better or that space better, as opposed to, it's not really my style. I'm not going to buy the house.
Yeah, I think you bring up two really great points there. I mean, the first one is, it is very difficult for the average buyer to imagine what a space is supposed to look like. It's very common in the newer homes, I would say 90s and later, where there's these combined spaces where you have dining and kitchen and great room concepts. And so there's this huge room that is really meant to, you know, take care of two or three different spaces. And it's very difficult for a buyer to look at this large room and go, okay, well, how is that supposed to be set up? So I think the staging really does help with the imagination part. Mm-hmm. The buyers can certainly imagine their own couch being there or a piece of furniture that they love. I would say that the most important aspect of staging that we've seen is that it makes the photography look way better. And when you think about the fact that nearly 100% of buyers today, we used to use 90, 95%, but I would say about 100% of the buyers today are doing their home search online. And that's the very first thing they see. And when you have this well-layered staging where you have multiple colors and multiple textures and all that kind of stuff, it just pops. And that is what creates the frenzy that goes onto the house. And this will be another topic that we can talk about later, but there is a psychology to the purchase of a home. And one of the very first parts of that psychology is creating the frenzy. So, you know, we have the 10 buyers showing up to the house at the same time. We have a line of people going out for an open house. And when all those folks see all those people, it's like, wow, if all of them want the house,
I want it too, right?
100%. So again, another topic, but it all starts with staging. If you don't have the staging, you can't have the photography. If you don't have the photography, you can't create the frenzy. If you don't have the frenzy, you can't get the multiple offers that you're looking for. So staging, folks, 100%.
Bingo. Get it done.
All right, so we'll move on to our main topic of the day. Have you been noticing a trend working with clients and speaking with real estate agents out in the community?
Prices are going up, and there's no indication of things slowing down right now. And buyers are really starting to get burned out. And you know, we call it buyer fatigue, right? Every week, your buyers every day almost on Zillow, whatever apps you're using, looking at houses every day. Go see a house, put an offer, don't get it. See another house, put an offer, don't get it. And people have been doing this for 6 months, almost a year, since the beginning of COVID almost, right? And people are just, they're just emotionally drained.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt about it. I'm seeing it. We speak to a lot of real estate agents throughout the week, and we're hearing a lot of the same from them. They're seeing a lot of buyers bailing out of the market. Look, buying a home is incredibly emotional. In a good market, in a bad market, buying a home is very, very emotional. And it takes a lot out of somebody when they write an offer on a home and then they get rejected. I mean, I hate that word, but like, that's what it is, right? And you even sign a contract that said offer rejected. Like, who wants to be a reject, right? But it is incredibly stressful. And so these folks are waiting weeks on end sometimes for the right house to come up. Then they get all excited that finally there's a house in the neighborhood that they want and it has the number of bedrooms they want and this and that. And then they're told, sorry, you can't have it. And so they're stressing out. I would say that, you know, there's also, added stress in the way negotiations are happening today. I think buyers are bringing or taking on way more risk than they've ever had to. So not only are they paying way more than we've had, they've had to in the past, but they're also taking on risk. And we'll talk about that with writing non-contingent offers and not really having a good idea of what the condition of the home is when they're writing offers and all that kind of stuff. So, so we wanted to talk about, should a buyer be bailing? Should a buyer not? And, I think the logical next question would be, if they do bail from the market now, what would have to happen in order for a buyer to feel comfortable jumping back into the market?
Well, I think for a lot of people, it's just stress level, right? So they need to bring that stress level down. And what's causing that stress is competition. You know, there's very few homes on the market and it's competitive. So for people to be more comfortable, we need to have more homes on the market to free up some inventory, less competition.
Fewer buyers.
Fewer buyers. Interest rates need to come up so that more people, I guess, essentially get priced out.
So let's talk about that. So
shrinks the buyer pool.
So naturally, what's causing the stress and what's causing buyers to have to pay 100. I mean, we had a listing recently in Davis, not we, but there was a listing in Davis recently. We listed for 1.1 million and it ended up selling for 1.31. So $210,000 over list price. I'm sure there's a bunch of other crazy stories, mm-hmm. but we've had multiple transactions, you and I, where we're paying, where our buyers are paying, or I'm sorry, the buyers on our listings are paying $100,000 more. So that's pretty commonplace, I think. So what's causing the stress is this competition, having to pay way more. And so in order to reduce competition, what needs to happen? Interest rates. Well, we need to have a reduction in buyers, right? And so what's going to cause a reduction in buyers?
Interest rates are going to creep up, and that's going to price those people that were borderline. They're going to get priced out of the market. So a smaller buyer pool.
Correct. So, I mean, you have an example of that recently where the buyer, like they're having to come to the table with a certain amount of money in order to buy down their interest rate.
Yep.
So that their total expense per month doesn't exceed their debt to income ratio.
Right. Yeah. He is very, very borderline. You know, we're looking at $300,000 homes and the market basically told him you're not going to get a home for $300,000. So we had to push that up to 330, which is pushing his numbers to the limit. His debt to income is like absolutely capped out, maxed out.
So let's talk debt to income real quick, just mm-hmm. for the sake of our listeners. I know that this may be a little bit confusing, but I think this is, we're getting to a very important point here, a really important point. But debt to income ratio. So when you're qualifying for a mortgage, essentially what the lender is saying is that your total monthly debt, which would include your mortgage, credit cards,
car payments,
anything like that, any of that, that cannot exceed a certain percentage of your total gross income. And that can vary lender to lender, but let's just call it probably anywhere between 35 and 45% mm-hmm. debt to income ratio. So what that means is that your total monthly debt, which would include, again, your mortgage, your car payments, your credit cards, that type of stuff, cannot exceed 45% of your gross income, maybe less depending on the lender. So as prices increase, your monthly payments is increasing. It makes it more difficult. So no doubt that the prices going up are going to bring buyers or going to take buyers out of the market. Interest rates are also going to increase. That's going to have to happen, I think. And so we've got some figures here that we ran. A 1% interest rate. So right now we're sitting at about 3%.
Just below. 2.875 is the lowest I've seen for like an average right now, about 3%, give or take.
Yeah. So it just depends on the loan program that you have, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. But these are interest rates that we've never seen in our lifetime.
Historically rock bottom.
And I know that Andrew's only about 28 years old, so his lifetime's not that long.
I wasn't around in the 80s when it was 17%.
Yes. When my grandmother and my parents were selling real estate back in the 80s, the interest rate was 17%. when I bought my first house in 2005, the interest rates had just dropped down from the 9% range down to 7.5%. And everybody was like, oh my gosh, what jump into bargain. The market, you know? So I would say that historically, let's call it 7% is going to be kind of where interest rates are. So we're at a 3% interest rate right now. Don't think we're ever going to see the one. I don't know how long we're going to stay here, but once we leave these low interest rates, I don't see us coming back. But back to the point, 1% interest increase on a $600,000 house would increase your monthly payment by $250 a month, just 1%.
So, and that's interest. That's just money additional that you're just burning just on interest because
it's gone.
Of the rate.
Yeah.
That's it.
And in 2007, 2008, 9, 10, when the market was really, really bad, interest rates were about 5.25%. So the government was trying to stimulate the market. They were trying to bring all this stuff in. And even then, we didn't have interest rates like this. So we're talking about a 1% interest increase. But, I mean, it's very feasible that interest rates go up 2% or 3% in time.
Well, we're only down where we're at because of COVID, right? The economy was shut down for, what, 6, 8, almost a year in some cases. And they're trying to keep interest rates down to keep everything stimulated, money flowing and whatnot. So I don't think we can stay down here for forever. So we have to expect it to go up. You know, a national average over time is about 7%, right?
Yeah. But we're going to play it really conservative. 1% adds $250. Here's another really startling statistic. That would add $80,000 to $90,000 to the total cost of your home over the period of your loan.
30 years.
30-year period, you're going to be paying an extra $80,000 to $90,000. Again, that's just money that's gone.
That's just wasted money on interest.
Not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. For a 1% interest increase, 2%, you can double all these numbers. Now, let's look at it from a different perspective. That $250 that you're going to be paying towards interest and nothing else, if that $250 were going towards a mortgage payment, how much would that increase your buying power? Actually, I know that answer. I don't know if you know that answer.
Right, about what, 30,000 bucks?
$30,000. So that extra $250 that's being wasted could potentially, if you purchase now, would be going towards the purchase price, which would be an increase of $30,000 in buying power. I think that's pretty cool. It's pretty significant. Then there's the third concept. If we wait, how much are homes going to appreciate between now and the time that the market starts its decline?
Well, we've seen a 20% increase in the last year alone. So if we were to go conservatively, say 10% over the next 12 months, where does that put us?
Or just, let's just play it even more conservative, because I'm not so convinced that the market's going to start making a correction even in a year. I mean, we have a massive housing shortage going on. There's a lot of different things that are going on.
We have right no now. Indication of the market slowing down right now.
Yeah. But let's play it super conservative, and let's just say that the market has to increase or will increase 10% between now and the time that it starts its decline.
Okay.
On a $600,000 house, that equates to another $60,000. So, Nate, let me know if this is confusing, but the my numbers are saying that a 1% interest increase would increase the cost of the loan by $80,000 to $90,000. It would decrease your buying power by $30,000. And then you would have another $60,000 in appreciation between now and the time that you decided to buy, potentially.
So what I'm hearing is if you wait, you're going to be spending a lot more money for a lot less house.
I'm saying $160,000 to $180,000.
Which
conservatively.
Is
conservatively.
That's significant. That's really, really significant.
That is conservative. So now going back to the original question was, what needs to happen in order for a buyer to feel comfortable jumping back into the market? Competition has to reduce and all that kind of stuff, right? So having that luxury of not jumping into a market when it's competitive looks to cost about $160,000 to $180,000. So if you wanted to kind of jump into, if you wanted to keep things all equal, then naturally you would want the market to decrease 160 to, after it hits its peak, you would want it to decrease 160 to 180,000 in order to get back to where we are today.
Right.
So we don't know how long this write up is going to be. Could be 2 years, could be three. We don't know.
So it could potentially be more than $180,000.
100%. I mean,
if the market does, you know, increase more than say 10%,
10%.
Conservative numbers, right? Unreal.
Yeah. And then you have to, and then you're going to have to wait for it to depreciate that much. We don't know if it will depreciate that much. I mean, I'm getting really into the weeds right now.
I mean, this isn't like a push to say, hey, buy now. Like, you know, we're just laying out the numbers for you and saying, hey, these are the implications if you do decide to wait. Yeah. And these are the conservative market numbers. This is potentially how much, you know, waiting 12 months is going to cost you.
Yeah.
I think the big takeaway, guys, is yes, there's a stress level to trying to buy a house right now because of the competition, but that's the trade-off you're making. Is it worth that $160,000 to $200,000 to have less stress? And it's a decision people have to make themselves, but there's a price to everything, and that appears to be that price of convenience, so to speak. Does that sound right?
Agreed. Absolutely. And you're right. There is a cost. And there are people who, it's not, you know, it's not always about the money. It's not always about saving the most amount of money. Sometimes it's about your mental health.
I mean, you have an example of that, right? A client recently.
Yeah. I mean, I had a client that this was kind of during COVID. So there was some added stress there, but I mean, they called me up and they're like, look, I haven't slept in 3 days. I've been getting sick and my anxiety's through the roof. And it's like, bro, like your mental health is more important than anything else at this point.
100%.
So if you're going through that level of stress, I think that's an easy decision. Like who cares about the 160, 180?
Right.
Right. So, big deal.
So I think it just comes down to risk management. If you can stomach the market, you can stomach the competition, jump in the market. If it's too much stress for you, then, you know, now's the time to make your exit.
Yeah. And again, I know that sounded like we're really pro buying right now. And ultimately we're in a position where we want to do whatever's best. But in my conversations with folks, even real estate agents for that matter, I don't think people were really breaking it down in that fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they had a clear understanding of what waiting actually could mean. And I think it's important to say that none of us have a crystal ball here. Markets go up, markets go down. Nobody can predict the future.
If we could, we'd be millionaires.
But if we were all millionaires, would that really matter?
I guess not.
It would just raise the price of everything.
Yeah.
So the question that pops to my mind is, I'm talking to a couple of realtors here, and what role does, and I know you guys are dealing with a lot of emotional issues with buyers, with sellers, et cetera, et cetera. What are some things that people can talk to you guys about that might make the process, I guess, emotionally easier for them as buyers who are looking to get into a house, or sellers for that matter?
Well, I think the number one contributor to stress is the unknown. They don't know what the future is going to look like if they make this particular decision. And so I think speaking to a realtor and getting a clear understanding of what the risks really are, not just your perception of risks, but what are they? And what does this process look like? The more you know, the more comfortable you will be. And that's true in all segments of real estate.
Mm-hmm.
When we were going through the whole foreclosure and short sale crisis, it was the same thing. So just having a clear understanding, if your main concern is paying too much for a home, would it be helpful to hear the figures that we just threw out? Would it be helpful to hear that the real risk for you, if money is your number one thing, the real risk for you might be waiting, right? So anyway, that's my thought there. But, you know, speaking of risk, So buyers are more stressed out today than I've ever seen them in my 16-year career. And obviously the competition's playing a huge part in that. But I also believe that their risk has increased significantly over the last couple of months because of the way that the deals are being negotiated today. Would you agree with that?
100%. When you have 15 buyers lined up to buy a house and you're representing a buyer, you know, we're at the point where we're seeing a lot of these deals where the buyer is taking the house in its as is condition. That's a lot of stress, right? Is the roof okay? Is the foundation okay? Is it going to fall down? You know, what's the history on the house? Did someone die in the house? And, you know, buyers are just having to go in blindly and just take it, because if they don't, the person behind them is going to.
So the buzzword that we've been hearing recently is non-contingent offers. What does that mean?
Well, you have three, in an average deal, you have three main contingencies. You're going to have your inspection contingency. It's like a condition, right? As a buyer, I come in, I have a condition period. I take a look at the house. If I'm okay with it, I move forward to the next step. You have three main ones: inspections, appraisal. Bank sends out an appraiser, make sure the house is worth what you're offering. And then you have your loan contingency, where obviously your loan gets approved. And once you give up all of those contingencies, your deposit that you put down at the very start of the purchasing process is now up in the air. If you decide to cancel after removing your contingencies, the buyer or the seller has the right to keep your deposit. And we're seeing offers where these buyers are coming in with no contingencies at all, and their deposit is at risk right out of the gate.
Yeah. So deposits, by the way, are getting higher and higher. In California, at least 3% is the maximum earnest money deposit that a seller can retain in a breach of contract. But in the Sacramento, Solano areas, in most of Yolo County, we were seeing, you know, maybe 1% earnest money deposit. In Davis, we were customarily seeing the 3%, but in other areas, we're seeing 1%. That 1% is now turning into 2% and turning into 3%, even in some of those outlying areas. Mm-hmm. So that's increasing risk. And then going back to the inspection contingency, so that's generally speaking, in my whole entire career, I've never seen buyers waiving that inspection contingency. That inspection contingency is very important. That's when you're going to get your home inspectors. That's when you're going to get your roof inspectors and all those people to go through the house and take a look at it.
And it was a negotiating point too.
It absolutely was. Yeah, we would negotiate it. But I mean, that's an important piece to the process. I mean, I think it's important to know whether or not you're purchasing a home that's going to have $100,000 worth of work that needs to be done. I mean, we kind of talked about that in the last episode mm-hmm. a little bit. So for somebody to waive that inspection contingency and buy an unknown, you know, Nate, you were just talking about like, what, how do you reduce stress? And my answer was, you know, kind of help them understand the unknown. Well, I can't help a buyer understand the unknown if we don't have any inspections on a house.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like gambling at that point.
Good. I think that's a great analogy. I'm not much of a gambler either.
Me either.
I'm a very numbers-oriented, I'm a very calculated person. So that's an inspection contingency. The appraisal contingency, that's a whole nother concept. So traditionally speaking, in the past, we would have an appraisal contingency. And so a buyer enters into contract with their lender, and then the lender hires an appraiser to go out and appraise the home. Obviously, the lender doesn't want to lend money on a home that's not worth at least the amount that they're lending on. So they have this third-party appraiser go out and appraise the house. And in the past, if the appraisal came in low, then there was this opportunity to potentially negotiate with the seller and ask the seller to reduce the price of the home down to the appraised value. And that was actually pretty common, especially in the 2007 through 2012 era, 2013 era. In today's world, almost always, it feels like, I don't know, maybe that's a little bit vague, but I would say 60% of the time, appraisals are coming in low because it's such a competitive situation out there and people are having to pay so much more than every other buyer that they're paying more than what a house is worth. That's the reality of it.
Well, the appraiser is there to protect the bank, right?
Yes.
The bank doesn't want to pay you or give you a loan for $1 million on a house that's worth $600,000.
Of course. So what's happening is these buyers are having to pay $100,000 more than what their neighbor's identical house sold for 2 months ago. And so these appraisers are going out and they're saying, well, you paid $1 million for the house, but every other house like this home that you just bought sold for $900,000. And therefore, we as the independent appraiser are going to tell the bank that your house is worth $900,000, not $1 million like you bought. So then the lender's going to come back and say, well, hey, check this out. You're $100,000 short. And so the only way that a buyer can make that happen without negotiating with the seller, which is not going to happen, is to bring in an additional $100,000 to cover the difference. So let's say a buyer is bringing in a 20% down payment. That means the lender is willing to loan 80% of the value of the home. So if the value comes in $100,000 short, that means the buyer has to come in with an extra $100,000 above their 20% to make this work. All right. Now here's the trippy part. Buyers, in order to compete today, in many instances, not all, by the way, I don't want to make this sound like every deal is like this. I told you 50 to 60%. In order to make this happen, buyers are having to waive that appraisal contingency on the outset. That's pretty scary, especially when you're seeing houses that are appraising $100,000 low. So you're buying this house and you don't even know what the house is going to appraise for. You don't even know if you're going to have to come into with an extra 10 grand or an extra 100 grand. Would that make a difference to you?
Well, I mean, if you're me, I don't have an extra $100,000, you know, laying around to if I run into the situation as a buyer, right? So it's a lot of stress. But for the buyers that do have that money laying around, they can go above and beyond all these other buyers. They come in non-contingent, you know, and they're the ones that are winning out right now.
Yeah. Third primary contingency that we're seeing be removed at the outset is that loan contingency. Now, granted, buyers are going, they're getting pre-approved prior to going out and writing offers on these homes. Mm-hmm. I get that. And these lenders are just inundated right now. And so they're doing the best they can to vet these buyers and make sure that they're approved because they don't want to provide false hope to the buyer. And yet it's not always happening. And mistakes are made. We had one recently where the lender approved the buyer as a W-2 employee, but it turned out that she actually was a self-proprietor. She didn't know that. We just assumed that the lender did it the correct way. So then mm-hmm. we go into escrow and suddenly the underwriter comes in and says, hey, this isn't looking right. So she ended up having to go and get money from her family. Like we're talking tens of thousands of dollars to make this work. But my point being is that we don't actually know. Like we get this pre-approval and we assume that it's okay. But after we go into pre-approval, that loan officer, who's really the sales representative for the mortgage lender, mm-hmm. Kind of steps out of the picture. And all of a sudden this underwriter comes in and the underwriter doesn't care at all about sales. They're just there to protect the bank.
Make sure that the buyer can actually afford that loan.
Yeah. So they're going to go through line by line by line on those bank statements. I feel like we're probably scaring buyers like crazy right now, but this is the truth.
It's important information.
This is the truth.
And I think the point we can make here is that when you're getting pre-approved, a lot of lenders tend to overestimate your purchase price that you can afford. They say, hey, you can afford $600,000, but that's absolutely everything's maxed out to the hilt. No room for any, you know,
discrepancies
at all.
And we've literally had underwriters come back and say, hey, you had a $10 deposit in your checking account 2 months ago. Can you write a letter explaining what that $10 was? So I mean, they go through line by line and it's a very detailed thing. Mm-hmm. And although it's a rare thing for loans to fall through today. There seems to be a workaround one way or another. It can happen. Right now it's getting better, but there's been some question about the type of employment you have and whether or not it was secure under COVID. And so you are employed, but then lenders were like, but maybe you're not going to be employed because of COVID, or, you know, so it's like, you know, everybody with the market, the way it is, everybody's starting to get a little bit nervous and they don't want to overextend themselves. Banks being, being part of that.
So I have a quick question, guys. And you're right. This is a little bit intimidating, and it almost feels more intimidating because yes, it's important. Yes, it's true, but it still starts to feel a little overwhelming with stuff. What could be a solution in terms of shopping around to different types of lenders? Because you've got all of your traditional banks. Are there other types of lenders people could explore and programs they could explore that might help alleviate that a little bit to especially someone who is dealing with those challenges about how their career or their job is being categorized?
So I think the best thing that you can do is go to a lender that would be willing to do a underwriting approval. Fully underwritten approval. And what that means is they're going to take all of your documentation and they're going to send it to the underwriter and they're going to approve your loan as if you were already in escrow. So they're going to do those line by line audits on your bank statements. And I would say some lenders are not willing to do that just because, again, they're inundated. I would also say it's important to work with a loan officer that you feel is really competent, right? So you have, I got to be careful here, but I kind of categorize lenders into three different categories. You have one who nobody knows. There's this big online company, maybe an example. Nobody has any relationships with them. Then you have lenders that maybe you have a friend, family who has a connection to them, and they've used them. So, you know, they're not totally unknown. And then you have lenders that are local and work with local real estate agents on a regular basis, and they've been vetted out quite a bit. So those are your three steps. So if you're working with a local lender who has a really great reputation in town, then I think you're going to be in much better hands and you're not going to have these hiccups that I'm talking about. So I'm trying to dance around that the best I can, but that's kind of my advice. And I agree that this is very intimidating and it may scare a lot of people from wanting to buy, but it's better to know this now. And if you're going to get cold feet and if you feel like you're over anxious now, then maybe now's not the time.
Right. And, you know, we have a bunch of colleagues, right? A bunch of friends in real estate. You know, we always talk and get together and they talk about their buyers and how stressed out they are. And I ask them, you know, what type of offers are you writing on these homes? And they're like, well, we've been writing offers for a year. We haven't gotten anything. And I'm like, well, what type of offers are you writing? Are you coming in at asking price? Are you coming in with really exceptional offers? And they go, oh, no, sometimes we even give them like $10,000 more than they want. And I was like, well, that's your problem right there. You need to realize, you know, what the market's doing around you and realize what these homes are selling for at the end of the day, right? 5, 10, 15% over. And I think as a buyer, not to scare them away or not to sound bad, but you really need to commit to writing really great offers that are going to be competitive, or else you're just going to be going through emotional stress and emotional drain for no benefit.
In all fairness, though, it's not easy for a buyer to just go in and say that they're going to pay 10 or 15% over a list price without having a clear understanding of what the genuine value and what the genuine interest is going to be in that house. Because there are many, many houses out there that are not even selling for list price.
Right.
So like, it's important that you don't just jump on to one of these automated values and systems online and say, mm-hmm. Oh, the house is worth this much. And so we're going to pay that. Like there's a lot of different variables that come into play and it's going to require somebody that's in the market to be able to analyze that for you and then present that information to you in a fashion that makes you feel comfortable. So the folks that are paying 10 or 15% over list price, they're doing it because they feel confident that it's the right thing to do. And that, I mean, the goal here is to overpay just enough to beat everybody else out, mm-hmm. but not too much.
Right. And that comes from having a good local agent that knows the market. Because on our listing on a couple weeks back, you know, sold for significantly over asking. And we received like a couple offers that were like 80 or 90,000 below asking.
Yeah. And that kind of segues into the next episode. So I don't want you to steal that thunder.
Sorry.
The next episode, we want to talk about these houses that are getting 10, 15, 20 offers. And we have the unique perspective that we're on the listing side for many of these. Mm-hmm. And so we get to see each and every one of those 15 offers and how they're written. And so we just thought it would be curious. It would be, you guys might be curious. It would be interesting to talk about and break down each one of those offers. And I think you might be surprised at what we see on our end. And it makes it fun to be able to do that. And then it allows us to give our buyers a different perspective as well, which then again can make them feel more comfortable about writing where they need to write.
Yeah. Gives you guys, you know, an inside look at what a seller is really ultimately choosing at the end of the day. And yes, you can use that tip to benefit yourself if you're out there writing offers.
Should be a fun episode. You're going to get the inside track.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Nate, did we just confuse the heck out of you there?
A little bit.
Shoot.
Just a little bit. I mean, there's a lot to process. And I think that's why it's important to actually take some time and have that one-on-one conversation. I mean, it just really highlights how important it is to have someone in your corner, your realtor in your corner, to be able to go, look, I'm confused. Can you explain that to me again?
I agree. I mean, we've got just a short period of time on a podcast like this. We're not able to hear your questions, hear your concerns or any of that kind of stuff. So it is very difficult to kind of have a conversation about this to the masses. It really does need to be individualized. And so I can't agree with you more. I think the key point that you should take away here is that, well, one, there's a good chance that waiting is going to cost you. But the second thing is that real estate is a very complex transaction these days, much more complex than when my grandmother was doing it back in the 70s and the purchase agreement was literally a half a page. So it does, I would encourage you to get with a real estate agent and go through these details one by one. And we're real estate consultants. We don't even consider ourselves salespeople as much as we consider ourselves consultants. So get with your local realtor. Many a great ones. Give us a call if you do need some suggestions outside of the area. Obviously, if you're in the area, you're going to call us. But yeah, get with that. Get with a realtor. Get a really good consult and then decide where you want to go from there. So I apologize that it was so complicated and maybe produced a ton of anxiety, but I do hope that it was helpful. And we look forward to seeing you on the next episode.
If you guys think we're crazy, leave a comment. Let us know. We'll get back to you next week.
Check you later.
I will say this, guys, before we go. Yes, there was a lot of information, but I think it was also very important information to get out there. And having that knowledge is far more important than trying to feel your way in the dark and ask those questions, get the answers you need so that you can feel comfortable doing what you're doing. Because it's a big deal. It's a big decision. And get with people who can help you make the right one.
You bet. See you on the next one.